WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
The rise and demise of sick, gross, black, sophomoric, weird, pinko, anarchic, underground, anti-establishment humor is the subject of Tony Hendra's new book, Going Too Far. It surveys the generation of baby boom humorists, starting with their predecessors like Lenny Bruce and Mort Saul in the 50s, and continuing with 60s comics like Smothers Brothers and Richard Pryor, and the 1970s humor of the National Lampoon and Saturday Night Live. Tony Hendra is himself one of the comic voices to emerge from the baby boom. He first came to America from England to tour his club act. He stayed and went on to edit the humor magazine The National Lampoon and to direct their Woodstock spoof Lemmings. Hendra later edited and co-wrote several satirical books, including Not the New York Times and Off the Wall Street Journal. In the heavy metal movie parody, This is Spinal Tap, he played the role of the band's manager. I spoke to Tony Hendra from the NPR Bureau in New York. I told him I was surprised that he wrote his new book, which surveys and analyzes humor, because humorists frequently resist being analyzed.
Yes, well, it's a fairly dangerous occupation, writing about humor. You know, I mean, I tried to avoid the sort of basic problem that most people seem to get into, which is the sort of Germanic approach. You know, the joke goes in the ear and it activates the lumbar muscle, you know, and then it's a contractions and then laughter is the result. You know, those kind of Freudian kind of explanations.
Right.
But I did actually. The book started as a sort of history of the National Lampoon, which I was used to be editor of for a while back in the days when it was good, and it became clear to me, you know, that the sort of roots and origins of the kind of stuff that we did when we were cooking there really went much further back than I had realized.
Well, you describe, you use the phrase boomer humor to describe the kind of humor that the Lampoon was part of. Yeah, why don't you describe what you mean?
Well, it's an unfortunate term, but and so is rock
you
and roll.
You made it up, right?
Right. So is rock and roll, you know. No, I mean, it's self-explanatory to the extent that it's a humor, I think, that is sort of peculiar to what we call the baby boom generation, whatever that is. I actually do think that perhaps the comparison to rock and roll is not without merit, in the sense that I think our generation has as distinctive a kind of humor as our music is, and you know, that's why I set out to try and put it all in one place.
One of the distinctions you give to this kind of humor is that it frequently goes too far, or that people think it would, and that it tackles previously off-limit subjects. And I wonder what you're comparing it to. You're comparing this to, say, Bob Hope, whose humor seems very tame by comparison?
Well, it's, I mean, there's two issues here. One is that this is not the only kind of humor. You know, I'm not suggesting that there's no other kind that makes people laugh or should. You know, there's easy listening and there's rock and roll and there's heavy metal. I mean, this is a certain kind of humor, you know, other kinds of humor continue parallel. But I think from a historical point of view, the most interesting thing is that what preceded this was a very different and gentler and more trivial kind of humor that found its expression with people like extremely funny people, I should add, like, you know, Buddy Hackett and Milton Berle and Jackie Leonard, that whole tradition of sort of grand old ethnic comedians who really stayed in very safe areas of the park. And what made Mort Saul and Lenny Bruce and Second City critically different was that, on the one hand, they were quite determinedly intelligent. I mean, they were smart comedians in a world where basically the sillier and more stupid you were, the funnier you were. And they also dealt with issues which previously had been completely off limits: the Cold War, sexism, racism, all kinds of issues which comedians wouldn't touch with a barge pole before that.
Well, for a while you edited mm-hmm. National Lampoon mm-hmm. and you wrote for them. Now, you were something of an outsider in the sense that you were British, so there... here's what I think. You know, that there were probably a lot of, like, American in-jokes and jokes about Howdy Doody and TV shows and things like that uh-huh. that you maybe weren't that keyed into having come from England. I don't know. Were you... from a slightly different...
I think I better shoot myself.
Oh, yeah. Is this what the question made you think about?
I think yes, obviously, a great deal of... I have been in this country for a quarter of a century, and I'm beginning to understand, you know, that you say can't, not can't, stuff like that. But no, it took me a long time to understand the nuance of, if you like, to learn American in both the language sense and the cultural sense. But
what I'm thinking is that so much of the Lampoon and a lot of humor is based on little shared experiences,
mm-hmm.
and you know, TV shows, radio shows, bubblegum cards, things like that, that you wonder, you know, how much of it would relate, you know, overseas.
Well, it's, as I say, first of all, I've spent almost all my professional career here.
Yeah.
And I was one of the original editors of the Lampoon, so I mean, however, I suppose I got away with it somehow. It does seem to me, though, that there is something else special about this kind of humor, which actually I hadn't thought about before. I mean, there was a very parallel and similar phenomenon in England, which began in the mid-50s, as this kind of humor did in America, with people like Peter Sellers and The Goon Show and Peter Cook and Dudley Moore and Beyond the Fringe, and That Was the Week That Was. A very similar kind of humor that... you know, took on very similar kind of targets. I mean, I think one of the things that distinguishes this kind of humor is that it was not based in the trivial. It was not based in, you know, the recognition of, you know, an old-time television commercial. It was about the Pentagon. It was about, mm-hmm. You know, it was about the church. It was about religious and sexual hypocrisy. It was, in a sense, those are universal subjects. I don't think it matters what language you speak.
You describe the Lampoon as having turned on the last thing that was sacred, which was that generation itself, the generation writing the Lampoon.
Uh-huh. Well, I think that's that was one of... I think, actually, that's always been the saving grace of boomer humorists. I mean, that they were able to be as funny about themselves as they were about the people that they were attacking. I mean, Jules Pfeiffer is a prime example of that. I mean, his stuff is... His stuff right from the start was as much about people who you would assume were on his side as it was about, you know, the half-wits in charge. And I think we not only carried on the tradition in its more obvious ways, like, you know, attacking the government and organized religion and so off, but we also identified the new generation of half-wits, you know, the managers of Woodstock Nation, who were just as full of it as the last lot. And that was one of our unique things, I think, at the Lampoon.
Sure, you did a whole parody of Woodstock called the Woodshuck Festival.
Sure, Lemmings.
Yeah, event, yeah.
Which, that was an off-Broadway hit in 1973. That actually had Belushi and Chevy Chase and Christopher Guest. Pretty impressive bunch of people.
Did you offend any people with it?
I remember... It was a series of the whole second act was a parody of Woodstock, and it had a series of parodies of singers, not all of whom were at Woodstock, some of those singers actually came to see the show. I remember one night James Taylor and Carly Simon came, and it was an extremely savage James Taylor parody in the show, and he didn't laugh at all. Carly, however, fell on the floor.
and remember, they got divorced later on.
Yes, yes. I probably caused that.
Did you write that parody?
No, actually, Sean Kelly wrote that. And
now you did. You did write a John Lennon parody on.
Right? Yes, that was on an early National Lampoon album called Radio Dinner. As a matter of fact, John Lennon wrote that parody. All the words in that song are from the Primal Therapy interviews, Primal Scream interviews he gave to Rolling Stone. So every single word in that song is actually was actually from the very gut of John Lennon.
Do you remember any of it? Could you recite some of it for us?
No, I really couldn't. Not even on National Public Radio.
Oh, right. Okay.
You perhaps don't remember quite how demotic it was.
Right. Now, did Lennon ever hear it?
Yes, apparently some idiot in KRLA played it to him and Yoko, and he was described as emerging ashen-faced after hearing it.
Now, I don't know if he was important to you musically, but how did it make you feel knowing that he was really offended by it?
Well, I didn't know that for sure. I mean, I certainly don't think. Well, let me. It was a strange experience. I mean, I don't think you can really do satire, and certainly not parody, unless you, in a funny kind of way, love your target. You know, it did seem to me that what those interviews were indicating was a sort of egomania, you know, a kind of self-obsession that Lennon was getting into at that time, which was very disappointing because he really was a hero of mine. So, I mean, I don't really care if he was offended. I think the song actually had a point to make, but it was only worth making because I cared about him.
Another parody that you wrote was Deteriorata, based on Desiderata.
Uh-huh.
Could you recall for us what Desiderata was, and maybe you can recite a verse of Deteriorata?
Gosh, I can't remember it. Desiderata was this awful, soupy, sentimental thing. Go placidly amid the noise and waste, was it?
Yes.
It was sorry?
Oh, well, posters of it were hung on countless dormitory
Oh,
walls.
Yes. No, it was as popular as the Velvet Jesus. It was all over the place. And it was this dreadful sort of reader's... It was supposed to have been discovered in an old Pennsylvania church, I think, or something like that. And it had this sort of phony 18th-century diction.
And it was kind of Hallmark inspirational.
Yeah. But definitely came from sort of Reader's Digest. And so, anyway, we wrote a parody of it. I wrote a parody of it, which was called Deteriorata. And I really, honestly can't remember any of Deteriorata, except...
The part I remember is that you are a fluke of the universe. You have no right to be here.
Hey. Yes, pretty good. Let not the sands of time get in your lunch. Hire people with hooks.
That's right.
Coming back to me now. Yeah. Anyway, that became a not nearly so large selling poster, but we did sell a few of them.
Now, on one of your records, you write in your new book, Going Too Far, that RCA refused to release it unless you deleted the satires of relating to President Nixon and to Julian David Eisenhower. How did that wind up?
Well, that was the same album on which the Lennon parody appeared, and a number of other things, including an extremely nasty parody of Joan Baez. I must say, there were these very harmless things about David and Julie in bed, you know, with David saying things like, don't worry, honey, I took the pills, you know, that kind of stuff. I mean, real tame stuff. And what I was really worried about was that the record industry would just go nuts when they heard this sort of Lennon knock and Baez knock, and there was a Dylan parody on it too. But they didn't care a bit. What they cared about was the fact that they just sold something like $250 million worth of defense contracts to the Nixon administration. Well, they just made a deal. Anyway, this is RCA, of course, is a defense contractor. So the word came down that they wanted anything about Nixon off the album. And we refused to take it off, and they booted us. That's a common story with Boomer Humor, you know. I mean, that's what... You never know how you're going too far. I mean... I don't think Tommy Smothers knew how he was going too far. I don't think any of us did.
Well, certainly the risk you always take if your humor really cuts deep.
Yes, sure. But in this case, it didn't.
You know? Right.
I mean, I would have been much, much less surprised if somebody had said, you've got to take that John Lennon thing off. Yeah. You know, we can't possibly put that out.
You described the...
Right from the start, I mean, I realized that was one of the risks that you take. I mean, when I first came here in 1964, I was half of a comedy team. I was, since I weighed 240 pounds, I was considerably more than half of a comedy team. But our first job, I mean, within 24 hours we got this job, 24 hours getting off the boat, we got the job opening for Lenny Bruce.
You're kidding.
Yes, at the Café A Go-Go in New York. And it was just staggering because this guy was, you know, one of our sort of major idols, so we would sort of, I don't know why he needed us to open for him, actually. No one was remotely interested in our twittering British satire. But we would sit there night after night, you know, at the feet of this great man. And lo and behold, 3 days into the gig, in the middle of a set, the New York Police Department bounced up on stage and busted him. So, you know, our first lesson was that if you're too funny in America, you get arrested.
Boy, I see you didn't take that one to heart, though.
No.
It's interesting, you know, you describe P.J. O'Rourke, who was an editor at the Lampoon, uh-huh. as basically leading the Lampoon to its downfall. And what interests me about this is that O'Rourke is now known as a kind of Republican satirist, a conservative satirist. And I think
you don't see that as a contradiction in terms.
Well, here's what I'm going to say, that I think a lot of, you know, irreverent humor in America is always associated with liberalism or with the left.
Mm-hmm.
And here he was at the Lampoon, being pretty conservative then, too, I think. As a matter of fact, you say someone described him as a narc, because you always thought you could see his police-issue shoes showing out from his bell-bottoms.
Uh-huh.
Well, how do you think he changed the Lampoon?
Well, actually, I'd like to address the issue of satire being left-wing, because I don't think that's necessarily true at all. I think it seems to me a distinctive of this humor that it dealt with, you know, authority figures. It deals with people more powerful than you, and it doesn't really matter who's in charge, whether they're left-wing or right-wing or in the middle. You know, if the chances are that if someone's in charge, there's something ludicrous about them. And that's the job of satirists, is to point that out. I think, in fact, historically, you find that, you know, this kind of satire flourished more than ever under the Kennedy administration, which I suppose is as close to left-wing as we've gotten in the last 30 years. And, you know, that sort of gives the lie to the fact that it was necessarily left-wing or liberal. The other thing, though, is that I think what O'Rourke and a lot of people like him do is, and it's something I find obnoxious and not at all funny, is that they make fun of people who are less powerful than them. In other words, they make fun of the powerless, whether that's whatever form that takes. And I just simply don't find that funny. I mean, I think it's not a worthy sort of target, and. The kind of changes that O'Rourke and other people too made in the Lampoon seem to me to both, you know, have destroyed it as a sort of reasonable expression of its generation's humor, and just to have cheapened it, you know, in a way that eventually destroyed it. I mean, I think the Lampoon, if it had, so to speak, grown up with its audience instead of becoming a teenager's magazine, could have become the New Yorker of its generation.
So very briefly, you thought that the magazine became more adolescent, catering to...
Oh, quite deliberately.
Tittering type jokes, sex jokes.
Yes, I mean, I don't know if you can put this on the air, but we used to call it zits and tits.
Mm-hmm.
That's, you know, that kind of humor became the only kind of humor that the National Lampoon specialized in.
Well, Tony Handra, I want to talk with you more about humor and about your own life, but we're going to take a short break first. My guest is Tony Handra. He's been an editor of the National Lampoon. He produced some of their records, and he edited Not the New York Times, Off the Wall Street Journal. He appeared in This is Spinal Tap as the manager, and he's the author of a new book about humor called Going Too Far. We'll talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is humorist Tony Handra, author of the new book Going Too Far. One of the things you write in your book is that you think some of the people who were associated with the Lampoon and with Saturday Night Live ended up becoming some of the things that they parodied, especially because of their involvement and or over-involvement with drugs.
Well, actually, I'm not sure that drugs were quite as big a sickness as stardom.
Oh, ego. Uh-huh. Right.
It seemed to me that, I have really no idea what, certainly there weren't many drugs around the Lampoon. There was a lot of alcohol, but certainly wasn't many drugs.
Uh-huh. And
I have no idea what was around, say, SNL. I think Saturday Night was, probably did, on the whole, in retrospect, did the cause of boomer humor somewhat of a disservice. Partly, I think, because it was promoted as being something that it really, in effect, wasn't. I mean, it gave the appearance of being, you know, radical and revolutionary, whereas, in fact, what the material, if you go back and look at the material, what the material was actually very tame. And I think people sort of got the idea that they were getting real going too far humor when, in fact, they weren't. They were getting parodies of Star Trek.
You know, there's a big comedy renaissance going on in America, lots of comedy clubs, more comedy shows on television. Mm-hmm. Yet you end your book Going Too Far with a chapter called Semi-Epitaph, in which you mourn the near death of Boomer Humor.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't think it's I don't think it's dead. I certainly think it's probably in intensive care, but it's not actually
what are the symptoms?
Straight-lined yet. Well, I think one of the symptoms is that, to be quite honest, with some exceptions, which I'll get to, I just don't hear many comedians today, however talented they may be, dealing with anything that I care about. You know, I mean, you have this tradition where, you know, Saal dealt with the Eisenhower administration, the military, Bruce dealt with moral and religious hypocrisy, Carlin dealt with Catholicism, Lily Tomlin deals with, you know, feminist issues, and what have we got today? Stupid pet tricks. Great, let's rip the lid off stupid pets, huh? That's, you know, that's about where we're at. That's as shocking and as dangerous as it gets. And I quite honestly, I think pets are stupid, but I don't really have to be told. It just seems to me that most of what I see in here today is not about things that that you know cut deep at all.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask?
I should say, by the way, that I do think that there are exceptions to that. I mean, obviously, you know, most of these people are not by any means dead. I mean, I think Carlin continues to be a great comedian, mm-hmm. and I actually think that of the sort of late 80s funny people, the most interesting are the women. You know, and I include Lily and Whoopi and Elaine Boozler and Roseanne Barr amongst all those people. They seem to me to be much more sort of lively and I don't know, perhaps they have more to be angry about, but much more than their male counterparts.
Tony Hendry, can I ask you a question that might be totally off the wall and ludicrous?
No.
Thanks, I'll do it. Yeah. Have you ever been a monk or a priest?
Yes.
Oh, okay. I wasn't sure if I'd made that up or not.
No. I was actually for a Benedictine monk for not very long. I was a postulant, which meant I spent about 6 months in the monastery.
It's maybe not, but it seems to me to be two really different professions here, being a monk and being a humorist. Can you mm-hmm. see any connection between the two?
Well, I think Jesus was a comedian. I do. I actually think he probably made people laugh with some of that stuff, you know?
Uh-huh.
You know, camel through the eye of a needle, all that. I mean, that probably passed for good stand-up humor in biblical times.
Well, did you consider yourself very funny back in the days when you were a postulant? No, seriously, some humorists say that they never had a sense of humor till they got older or they didn't think about it.
Uh-huh.
I have heard that from...
Well, I don't know. I suppose. I might be different in this respect. But I must say I've always had a certain sort of seriousness of purpose about what I do for a living, even though it's supposed to make people laugh. And I suppose there's some connection there. And I think that's you know. But I mean I remember certainly going to see Beyond the Fringe, you know, and I went in as someone fully expecting to re-enter the monastery after I'd finished university, and I came out wanting to be a satirist. And that's all it took, you know.
How did you get out? Did you say, Father, I changed my mind, I want to be a comic?
I don't remember, actually. I maybe I should go to confession. Jeez. Please, I made fun of the church. I made fun of the Pope. Yeah.
Well, you know, I could see how there'd be more guilt that you'd have to face doing irreverent humor.
Yes, I guess so. Yeah, I guess so. I think, as somebody said in the book, the thing about being a lapsed Catholic, which unfortunately I am now, is that even though you don't believe in hell, you know you're going there.
I've seen a lot of comics who strike me as real manic depressive, manic when they're on, but really depressed when they're off. I don't know if that's something that you feel is true, but if it is for a lot of people, I wonder if you have any insights about it.
Well, that's a real depressing question, Terry. I do think it certainly seemed to me that in the various sort of collectives of which I've been part one time or another, I've never met. I mean, I've couldn't identify a group of people who are so hard on one another. It's real tough being around very funny people because they just, you know, metaphorically pull your pants down all the time. And it's I don't know that that there is any more. I mean, manic depressives in the comedy community than there are in, say, you know, the Pentagon.
Well, let me ask you the much-awaited question, I'm sure, about forthcoming projects. What are you working on now?
At the moment, my main project is a sort of satirical opera, which I'm doing at Lincoln Center, which is based very loosely on Don Giovanni, except that it's about the Reagan administration, Act One and Act Two. So it's called Ron Giovanni. And it's about the greatest seducer of our time who seduces everyone in sight, including the American public, and then goes to hell.
Now, is it true you just shot a few episodes of Miami Vice?
Yes, actually two. I was. This is a great culmination of a distinguished comedic career. I was hired as a corrupt record executive. A big stretch for me, huh? my aim in life is to kill Don Johnson's new wife, Sheena Easton.
Oh, but you're probably under embargo against telling us whether the mission is accomplished.
Yes, I am. But right. But I can tell you that I did find myself on one shoot underneath Don Johnson at 3 o'clock in the morning, which is presumably the dream of some of us. He busted me.
Oh, dear.
Okay.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about humor and about your life. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Tony.
My guest has been Tony Hendra, and he spoke with us from the NPR Bureau in New York. He has edited the National Lampoon, directed the Lampoon satirical review Lemmings, co-created, produced, and wrote the British satire on TV Spitting Image, and appeared in the film This Is Spinal Tap. His new book is about humor. It's titled Going Too Far. It's published by Doubleday. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.